Chapter 32. When Dorothy Kilgallen experienced the ill effects of 3 barbiturates, combined with too much alcohol intake, and died in her townhouse master bedroom during the early morning hours of November 8, 1965, was she alone? Or was there indeed someone with evil intentions lurking that either left her to die or watched Kilgallen die in severe pain and did nothing to save her? Mark Sinclair's accounts of the staged death scene requires close examination of those who witnessed the time Kilgallen spent at the Regency Hotel Bar, located, as noted, 6 blocks from her townhouse residence. These witnesses recalled seeing what may be dubbed a mystery man with the famed journalist. The question presented is whether this man may be identified, permitting a plausible conclusion as to whether he may be the same man responsible for her demise. Most credible among the witnesses is the first-hand videotaped account of Catherine Williams Stone, a contestant on Kilgallen's final What's My Line program. Stone's interview is available at the DorothyKilgallenStory.org. Stone, who wore a low-cut top and black formal jacket, was able to stump Arlene Francis, Bennett Cerf, and guest panelist Tony Randall. But Kilgallen, still at the top of her game, within hours of her death, guessed Stone's unusual occupation, selling dynamite. Following the program, Stone, who lived in Madisonville, Kentucky, was asked to join the What's My Line staff at the Regency Hotel Piano Bar, located on a lower level. In the 1999 videotaped interview, she recalled Kilgallen had left the television studio alone in a CBS limousine before Stone and her friends were transported to the Regency Hotel in a separate limousine. She even remembered that a friend of hers opened the limousine door for Kilgallen. In the interview, Stone said, "When we walked in the cocktail lounge, there was this big, beautiful, long, baby grand piano. It was over there on the left, and then over to the right, way back in the corner, was sort of like a curved booth." Pointing to that area in a photograph, Stone said, "This is where Dorothy was, definitely in that corner, right there." Stone, a strong-minded woman with terrific recall, added, "And the man was sitting right next to her, and I mean close, because they were talking, or they didn't want anybody to hear, or what, you know? I could see they both had a drink. There wasn't any laughing, people joking, this and that and the other." She added, "They were talking. And the reason I know this is for the fact I kept an eye on her, because I wanted to talk to her afterwards to tell her, you know, that I enjoyed being there, happy she guessed my line, so on and so forth. In other words, you wouldn't have felt like going up there. I knew they were talking business, serious business of some kind. I had that feeling." While other people were enjoying their cocktails, Stone said, "I had my eye on Dorothy. I'd look over and what to see what was going on, because I wanted to talk to her. So that's the reason I was paying so much attention, and I wasn't having many cocktails, you know." Stone believed that since she wouldn't have had time to go home and change, Kilgallen was wearing the same clothes in the bar she wore on the What's My Line program. Stone said she was told the piano player was a favorite of Kilgallen's, stating, "She liked his playing, but when he finished a song, she never clapped. The way she was acting, it was strictly business with her that night. No giggling or laughing." Stone, unfamiliar with Kilgallen's private life, said she could not identify the man with Kilgallen. However, she had the impression he was younger than Kilgallen. Any suggestion the man might have been Johnny Ray falls on deaf ears, since his being present would have caused quite a stir in the bar. Later, when informed that Kilgallen died of a drug overdose, Stone said, "People wanted to know if I thought she killed herself from drugs and pills, and I told them I didn't believe she overdosed. She was as sharp as could be on the program and looked normal at the cocktail lounge. I thought maybe this man might have done something to her, that he might have killed her." Stone then agreed that maybe the man gave her something, got her out of there. asked if perhaps Kilgallen had been slipped a Mickey Finn, drugging a drink to render someone senseless, Stone agreed, stating, "This could have happened." That a powerful Mickey Finn, a drink laced with a psychoactive drug or incapacitating agent, especially chloral hydrate, was served to Kilgallen either at the Regency Hotel bar or perhaps even in her townhouse, could have been possible. However, since there was no evidence of chloral hydrate noted in Dr. James Luke's autopsy report or in the follow-up analysis by the chemist John Broich, this theory appears dubious. Press agent Harvey Daniels knew Kilgallen well from having pitched client items to her, as hundreds did each day, for her powerful Journal American column. These clients included the Regency Hotel. It was attempting to replace Delmonico's as the place to stay on Park Avenue. Daniels, reached by one of Kilgallen's fellow Journal American reporters, echoed Stone's recollections of Kilgallen talking to a man in the corner booth at 1 a.m. Daniels, who had described Kilgallen to a friend as being warmer, earthier, easier to talk to during this period of her life, saw Kilgallen and said she was bright, cheery, and a little high. The piano player, Kurt Meyer, also recalled Kilgallen being seated with a man in the booth. Neither Daniels nor Meyer provided any description of the man, and neither was ever interviewed by the authorities. Since a Mickey Finn is not the likely instrument of poison used to end Kilgallen's life, then, considering the effect of the two barbiturates discovered by Dr. Luke, secanol and tuinol, and the three barbiturates that were discovered in her bloodstream by John Broich, secanol, nembutal, and tuinol, is important. First, however, before learning more about the drugs, it is important not to discard the new evidence presented here regarding what Detective John Doyle said happened shortly after Kilgallen's death. Recall Doyle reported, "All I got from the ME's office was a slip of paper saying, 'Death due to visceral congestion.' No more detailed report than that. If there was any more cover-up on this whatsoever, it would have been down at the ME's office." They never went into detail. Had it been explained to me that there was an overly amount of barbiturates in her system, then I probably would have dug a little deeper. There was no indication at all that there was anything out of the ordinary. Since Doyle was not told there was anything out of the ordinary about Kilgallen's death, another opportunity was lost for there to have been an investigation of any sort into what happened. This apparently means the detective was either never told of the tuinol in Kilgallen's bloodstream, or never read the autopsy report, or never read it carefully. Otherwise, he would have known there was something out of the ordinary. In an ME report never released, this author discovered Dr. James Luke stated, "Visceral congestion is not a term I would use, and it was not the cause of death." Confusion thus reigns, since it is unknown why the potential that Kilgallen died of visceral congestion ever was considered. Why a note to Doyle included that alternative cause of death. Very suspicious, it seems, adding to the mystery of exactly how Kilgallen died. According to Dr. Donald Hoffman, it is correct to say that visceral congestion involves a drug overdose, typically seen in opiates, such as heroin overdose deaths, but overdose deaths from other drugs that are CNS, or central nervous system, depressants, can also produce this result. As noted, the condition causes a bloody froth emanating from the victim's nose and mouth, and according to Dr. Hoffman, may result in marked pulmonary edema, fluid accumulation in the tissue and air spaces of the lungs, and ultimately respiratory failure. Since Dr. James Luke refused to acknowledge Kilgallen having died of visceral congestion, there was no follow-up. Proving that this condition caused her death is impossible. Thus, focusing on the three drugs in her bloodstream is unfortunately the only path to follow. Doing so permits this information to serve as guideposts for analyzing the exact cause of Kilgallen's death and how administration of the drugs may have happened. A question also exists as to why Broich found traces of Nembutal on one of the glasses positioned on the nightstand by Kilgallen's deathbed. As revealed in The Reporter Who Knew Too Much, each drug is designated today as a Schedule II narcotic requiring a prescription. All three are barbiturates, among the most frequently employed of the hypnotic and sedative drugs used at the time. Information about secanol includes a white, odorless, hygroscopic powder possessing a bitter taste. It is a short-acting barbiturate, meaning the drug is activated within the person's bloodstream in 40 minutes or so, dependent on one's weight. While most people believe secanol, or sleeping pills, is a mild drug, if taken in stronger doses, it can be quite dangerous. In the states of Oregon, Washington, Vermont, Montana, and New Mexico, it is used for physician-assisted death through death with dignity laws. A step up on the danger ladder of barbiturates is pentobarbital sodium, Nembutal. Details include an odorless crystalline granules or a white powder with a slight bitter taste. It is very soluble in water and alcohol. The latter accelerates its effect below the normal 40-minute range of secanol. Taken in small or moderate doses or by itself, Nembutal is not a dangerous drug. However, Nembutal's powerful effects in high doses have led to its use in executions. Both Missouri and Texas have employed the drug for euthanasia purposes. Asked about the risks of a Nembutal overdose, San Francisco clinical pharmacologist Randall Boris told this author, "The problem with Nembutal is that there is a very thin line between taking the right amount and just a bit too much. There's a true low threshold of safety there." Tuinol's side effects include shallow breathing or respiratory depression and confusion, headache, dizziness or loss of balance, and difficulties with breathing. Tuinol can be very dangerous when abused. Death may result if even a small amount is taken in excess of the prescribed amount. Details of Tuinol include a combination of two barbiturates, secobarbital sodium and amobarbital sodium. It is a mixture of equal parts. The drug is a white, crystalline, tasteless, odorless powder, soluble in water and alcohol. Mixed with the latter, accelerates its normal effect of 40 minutes or so. Asked about the effect of any combination of the three, secanol, Nembutal, and Tuinol, Boris stated, "That would be quite lethal, shutting down the brain within a short period of time, as short as an hour or less." Each of the three drugs was packaged in very small capsules. Boris stated, "It's quite easy to break the capsules apart if someone chooses to do so, and then empty the contents into a glass of water or an alcoholic drink. Any mixture with alcohol is very dangerous and speeds up the effect considerably. Basically, what happens is that the person just stops breathing." Asked to confirm that respiratory depression may be a result, noted California cardiologist Dr. Stephen Pope told this author he agreed with that conclusion. When asked about the effect of the alcohol, Dr. Pope agreed with Boris that it would magnify the effect of the drugs. Regarding the traces of Nembutal on one glass confiscated by Dr. Charles Umberger and analyzed by chemist John Broich, Boris told this author, "The sodium, salts, in the Nembutal could leave a telltale sign on the rim of a glass." Boris added, "This would happen if the person taking the drug drank from the glass shortly after consuming the Nembutal. That would not happen if the drug had completely dissolved." Secanol and Nembutal leave some evidence of a bitter taste in any alcoholic drink. If this is the means by which, for whatever reason, the drugs are ingested, then something is normally added to mask that taste. Boris said that quinine, included in tonic water, could be the answer when mixed with drinks containing vodka or gin. There is not any notation of quinine being present in Kilgallen's system in Dr. James Luke's medical examiner documents. John Broich was never asked about this matter during his audiotaped interview. Neither, in all likelihood, would have known that Kilgallen's favorite drink of choice was vodka and tonic. Armed with a better understanding of the dangerous drugs infecting Kilgallen's body, one may turn to consideration of how these drugs were administered, how she was poisoned, and by whom. If it was the mystery man she met at the Regency Hotel bar, had he acted on his own, or as an operative, under orders to silence her?